Good evening. My name is Jessica Carlberg, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues here at Dickinson College. On behalf of the Clark Forum, Dickinson College, and the Department of English, I would like to welcome you to tonight's lecture, sponsored by the Belfer Creative Writing Lecture, entitled Clamor, the Poetics of Wartime. War brings home many personal tragedies. This has certainly been true of the war in Iraq, which began in 2003, and ended only last year with the complete withdrawal of all U.S. armed forces. As a result of the war, the U.S. Department of Defense counts 4,408 deaths and 31,922 wounded in action. What these statistics do not show, however, is the number of mothers, fathers, husbands, wives, and children that spend each day in fear for their loved ones. These statistics do not show the number of marriages that fell apart, the children who lost a family, or the families that welcomed the return of a soldier far different from the one they sent away. Numbers and facts cannot capture the emotional hardship experienced by those who remained at home. Poetry, however, is well suited to fill this gap. We are lucky to have with us tonight Elise Fenton, who brings her own experience of the war to her war poetry. Her poetry collection, Clamor, won the 2010 University of Wales Dylan Thomas Prize. She is the first poet and the first American to win the award. Her work also won the Cleveland State University Press's first book award in 2009. Other samples of her poetry and nonfiction works have been published in the New York Times, Best New Poets, and the Massachusetts Review. She has also been featured on the NPR segment, All Things Considered. She received a Bachelor of Arts degree from Reed College before obtaining a Master's in Fine Arts from the University of Oregon. At this time, I would like to ask you to please turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. A question and answer session will follow the reading, so please hold all questions until that time. A book sale and signing will follow tonight's presentation. And now, please join me in welcoming our guest, Elise Fenton.
I'm going to make a brief ruckus getting myself situated. Oh, there's a glass. Thank you for coming out tonight, this dreary, cold night. It's great standing room in the back there. And thanks for coming from the War College and from, I believe, the community. It's nice to see a lot of people out there. And it's nice to read for folks who have been there, too, or know what it's like, or that's not always the case. So I will work my way sort of piecemeal through Clamor and talk a little and read a little and talk a little until I see you nodding off. So Clamor begins with the poem Gratitude, which I know some of you have read, maybe even today in class. So I figure I would start with Gratitude. My gratitude to you as well. Gratitude. Wreckage was still smoldering on the airport road when they delivered the soldier beyond recognition, seeing God's hands in the medevac's spun rotors to the station's gravel landing pad. By the time you arrived, there were already hands fluttering white flags of gauze against the ruptured scaffolding of ribs, the glistening skull, and no skin left untended, so you were the one to sink the rubber catheter tube. When you tell me this over the phone, hours later, I can hear rotors scalping the tarmac gray sky, the burdenless lift of your voice. And I love you more for holding the last good flesh of that soldier's cock in your hands, for startling his warm blood back to life. Listen, I know the way the struck cord begins to shudder, fierce heat rising into the skin of my own sensate palms. That moment just before we think the end will never come, and then the moment when it does. So a lot of the poems in Clamor, really all the poems in this book, are kind of begun as just an experiment at how to get at this material that I was living and that was so fraught. It felt like there was just no language that I could throw at it that would stick. And I was talking with some students earlier today about how these poems were just experiments in form and in perspective and in voice. And the way that I began to kind of fight back my resistance toward getting down to the material was naturally thinking about the language and the language that we use to talk about war, that kind of newscaster language, friendly fire, for example, or collateral damage, these words that become kind of glosses on something that, you know, almost become imagistically lovely or actually reveal something much, much more brutal. But we sort of throw these phrases around very calmly. And so the newscaster language became kind of the touchstone for me. And I started with just obsessive meditations on the phrases that stuck. So this poem, Word from the Front, comes from the phrase, the corkscrew landing, which you probably know is the way that you have to arrive in Baghdad because of the no-fly zone is spiraling down into Baghdad, so it's protected. And it's a really lovely idea, the corkscrew landing. Word from the front. His voice over the wind-strafed line drops its familiar tone to answer, yes, we did a corkscrew landing down into the lit-up city, and I'm nodding on my end, a little pleased by my own insider's knowledge of the way planes avert danger by spiraling deep into the coned center of sky deemed safe. And I can't help but savor the sound of the word, the tracer round of its pronunciation, and the image, a plane corkscrewing down into the verdant green neck of Baghdad's bottle glass night. So I don't yet register the casual solemnity of newscaster banter falling like spent shells from both our mouths. Nor am I startled by the feigned evenness in my lover's tone, the way he wrests the brief quaver from his voice like a pilot pulling hard out of an engineless plummet, but only at the last minute and with the cratered ground terrifying in sight. And I remember this conversation, which did actually take place. I was really fortunate to be in communication pretty often with my husband, and so I would had this really guilty a number of guilty occasions of like talking to him on the phone, but really I was writing a poem, and it was like my brain had snagged on something, and he was talking, and I was listening, but I was really like opportunistically channeling this poem. Which felt it was a mixture of pleasure and guilt. This is another example of a poem that just began as an obsessive meditation on concertina wire. After the blast, it happened again just now. One word snagging like a fabric on a barbed fence. Concertina wire. You said, I didn't see the body hung on concertina wire. This was after the blast, after you stood in the divot, both feet in the dust's new mouth, and found no one alive. Just out of the shower, I imagine a flake of soap crusting your dark jaw, the phone a cradle for your bare cheek. I should say, love. I should say, go on. But I'm stuck on concertina, the accordion's deep inner coils, bellows, lung full of air contracting like a body caught in the agony of climax, graceless before the ballooning rush of air or sound, that battering release. And another kind of attempt at getting at this material was creating kind of a false sense of distance from it. So I went through a series of persona poems that I brought. I was in a, a workshop at the time, an MFA workshop, and I would bring these poems into workshop, none of which actually made it into the book, that were all like from the War Bride series. And there is one that kind of came of the series, but and every time my classmates would be like, you know, they'd be rolling their eyes like, oh yeah, here we go, the persona, the War Bride persona again. But while the initial poems from the War Bride series really didn't get off the ground at all, they did allow me to assume this voice as my own, which was a process of accepting that this was actually, you know, I had created this emotional space from the experience, using poetry as kind of a crutch to not access the reality for myself. And so slowly I wrote myself into my own experience in some really weird ways. So this is The War Bride Waits. Sometimes it's like the last scene in a Western, where only the horses are left grazing an apocalypsed field. There they are, stranded amid crabgrass in the blessing of their own bulky bodies, having survived the long ride, having missed the bullets of outlaws or the tragic implications of fate, quietly bathed in a gold light meant to signify the dawning end. There's always a fade-out, the rising bird on a bent wing, scrawl of names, meaning we should expect nothing more. No last plot twist, no surprise rockfall, no lover waiting off-screen to turn up for the hero's dream of death. This is the moment the dead are mercifully allowed to stay dead. The moment in the dull celluloid flicker when the last horse caught in the narrowing lens lifts its bent neck expectantly and looks around. See, this next poem, I had the thrill of performing in the Telling Project, which if you haven't heard of it, you should Google it. It's a great project. A friend of mine began at the University of Oregon and has since gone kind of viral. The scheme is that he interviews vets and vets' families, and then he turns it into a script, kind of like the Vagina Monologues, and then the vets perform it. And it's been all over the country, and actually got to perform this in D.C. in front of Michelle Obama, who is, in fact, much taller than she seems. Planting, Hayhurst Farm. A week since the last bombing brought you to your knees, since the day you spent shoveling human remains into a body bag marked for home. I don't know what to say. Neither of us has slept. But today, planting peppers on a farm in Oregon, nowhere near the war, I found myself midway down a row, on all fours, hands breaking open the rocky clods, coaxing the flimsy necks to stand. It felt like an exercise in good faith, my fingers blindly plunging, a brief tenderness exacted on every stalk. Some didn't make it through our rough caging. Some will never bear fruit. I don't know if this is even meant as consolation, but I want to tell you just how easy it became to plant the thin bodies in the ground, to mound up that dense soil and move on. A number of these poems found their form in dirt in some way. I was working at a farm in grad school, and I was working my garden and really just trying to do like anything to occupy myself that would also inevitably, against my will, turn into some kind of poetic fodder. So I fought it because I was trying, you know, it was an attempt at escapism that just brought me right back to particular reality. Wow, there's people in there too. It's pretty good. How many of you are there? Anybody else? Let's see. I was also talking with some students about the prose poems in the middle. And these poems, actually, I didn't really intend them to go in the book. And I wrote them as sort of journal entries that just to kind of keep me writing. But they found their way into the book, and I've found that they're sort of a nice break, I think, for people who are like, oh, finally, something like a sentence. And let's see. This poem, Commerce, I wrote while I was visiting my husband, who was stationed at Fort Hood at the time in Killeen, Texas. Anybody been out there? Yeah, Killeen, shitty place. But not near enough. And so my husband had this apartment briefly it was next to the fence, like the big wired fence, and across the street, and it was always getting flooded. And across the street, nobody really lived there, but there were these three dogs across the street, pit bulls. They were all pit bulls. There were three pit bulls. And as far as I could tell, nobody lived there, but there was a dude who would come to walk them, because I guess they were being used, he was training them to fight. And instead of, putting a leash on the dogs and walking them around the block, he would put a chain, like a fist-sized chain on these dogs, and then he would just let them go, and they would drag their chains, around the block. And that, so, it would be 7 in the morning, and this is my spring break from school, and my husband is at work, and, there'd be these three dogs dragging their chains out the window. And that sort of typified my time in Killeen. Commerce. There wasn't enough forgiveness to go around. Dogs led themselves around the block. At the pawn shop down the street, you could buy anything, even someone else's false teeth. The whole day it rained and then was sunny and then it rained some more. She was sitting at her desk reading a book. When she looked a word up in the dictionary, she remembered one from a dream. It was just like that, two for the price of one, and then action following word. How she pulled the plug from the wall and wound the cable up. How, when he came back into the room in his uniform, the wound opened some more, each meaning haunted by the next. By then, it was growing dark, and the whole western sky was gold, pried from a stranger's mouth. There are smaller prices for having survived. Here, and I'll read this one, since somebody was saying that she liked it. Complicity. I haven't read this in years. She's halfway through the line at the store when she overhears the clerk say, "My husband? He's off at war." The clerk leans both hands on the counter like an old grandmother in some country of ground freeze and broken glass. At the register, there are two women across a plastic counter. Do they want to tell each other everything they know about the war? Some complicities she's never felt. In the other country, women gum seeds in their mouths, let the empty shells speak for themselves. On the counter, the paper receipt curls back against itself. She reaches for spilled coins and feels a tongue push back against her teeth. Oh, it's funny how some of these poems, especially the ones that I don't read often, they've just become time capsules for me. I sort of feel, when I'm reading from this book, I feel like the Bob Dylan song or the lyric, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. Let's see. I'll read a few more from this book, and then I'll read a couple new poems. Let's see. And the epigraph for the third... There's three different kind of movements in the book. And the third, the epigraph comes from the final lines of Dante's Inferno, which, is kind of requisite reading for anybody who's thinking or writing about war. But those last three lines are, "Through a round aperture I saw appear some of the beautiful things that heaven bears, where we came forth and once more saw the stars. And I actually read this poem and that epigraph at a reading in my hometown last summer. And after I read that, I looked up and I saw my high school English teacher, who I'd first read The Inferno with and had written his own translation. And I could see him mouthing the words, like, there is Mr. V, no longer scary, mouthing the words out across the auditorium, which was pretty cool. Your plane arrives from Iraq for the last time. Texas overcast. The road toward post, needle pricked in brake lights. Start and stop of the heart's four chambers involuntarily bound. And once more, the sky's feathered jet stream. And once more, the dirge and caesura of rotors. And once more, the slow morse of the plane's body descending. And at the end of the longest sentence I've ever known, your face in the window's fogged aperture. Stranded noun, Rorschach of stars, beautiful thing. And that's a poem that started in, I mean, it's, you can see it's pretty close, but it started as a sonnet, as a formal sonnet. With rhyme and everything, and then it worked out of that form, which is what a lot of the poems went through various iterations of trying to get to a place where I could, where something would stick. As I imagine a lot of you know, there are a lot of dreams that come with knowing somebody at war, I'm sure having been at war yourself. I had this like relationship with my dreams. It became in my mind sort of affable. I started thinking of the dreams in kind of a collective. So this poem is called The Dreams. Oh, the dreams are back. The dreams won't let me alone. The dreams have gatekeepers in trench coats woven from tire shavings and thorn, and whenever I hasten toward the sleep of the sleep bludgeoned, the boulder placid in a tallest field of sleep, the gatekeepers shake the rattlesnake bushes that pillow my head and club the cracked parchment of my feet. Oh, the dreams are bitter, are creosote and char, and can't let me forget their dozen names. The dream of death or disappointment, the dream of the inscrutable, with its hot disks tattooed like your name into flesh, stripped guylines to hoist the crow-sorrowed horizon aloft. So this collection begins with gratitude and ends, at least penultimately, with infidelity, which is not actually the course of the experience, but it is the course of the book. Infidelity. When you were in Iraq, I dreamed you dead, dormant, shanked stone in a winter well, verbless object sunk half deep through the navel of each waking sentence. I dreamed myself shipwreck, rent timbers on a tidal bed, woke to morning's cold mast of breath, canted wide as a searchlight for the drowned. Dreamed my crumbling teeth bloomed, shrapneled bone light, bricks mortared into a broken kingdom of sleep, where I found you dream sift, rubbled, nowhere. Forgive me, love, this last infidelity. I never dreamed you whole. I'm going to read a couple of new poems that I chose, some of the ones that were not the give me a break from all of this material poems, although even those poems kind of became interning and returning as well. But the my latest obsession, latest recent obsession, was with the story when Osama bin Laden was captured and killed, the story, the narrative that unfolded and sort of in real time as we all watched about his wife, who initially, the report was that he had used her, he'd grabbed her and used her as a human shield, and she had been shot in the process. And then, like, as the days went on, it turned out that she had actually thrown herself in front of him, perhaps in some kind of act of defiance, that she had agency in this. And it was really interesting to watch the responses of people around me for whom this giving this woman some agency actually conflicted with the image that they wanted to impose on bin Laden. And anyway, that became kind of a starting point in a series that's called Human Shield, kind of imagining the human shield. What is it like? What does it mean to be a human shield, both poetically and literally? Human Shield. I was ready when you wanted me, shadow polished, severe, and human as a need. Forgive me, the one stray hair, unbidden skin, unwillingness to turn toward a lens. You said innocent victim, so I was beckoned from hearth trash and poplar, blind linen and a run of rubbled shut weeks. Even as you began to read, I was slipping slim rations, Kevlar rungs into the sleeve of each rib and rubbing cinders into the oilcloth of my face. How else did you think you'd find me but lacquer blacked and bandoliered, inked back to the vernacular just after you'd looked at me and looked away? This is another in that series of just thinking about the physical body of the human shield. Best to think of me as the body unbodied, closer to alloy than the imperfect seam weld of muscle to bone, all skeletal trace of tenderness ligamented loose by smelt or flame. As if it were possible to bear no memory of matter, less onion skin than cellophane caul unsuppled by air. But maybe you begin to see me best by not looking, the way you have to throw back the loose tarp of the sky to summon a few artless stars, or the heart's fugitive mechanics hotboxed beneath a wire-thumbed breast. Not quite a drowning in plain sight, because I've been working on my posture, keystoned tensile, the right curvature of tempered steel, but otherwise elegant, flexible, and amenable to order. Believe me when I say I always understood rule number one: don't think yourself impermeable, to mean be just permeable enough. I'm going to read. How are you guys doing? Are you hanging in there? Okay, I'm going to read three more new poems, and then I think there will be Q&A. Let's see. These are all pretty fresh enough that I still feel like a little that defensive tingle about them when I read. Sweet Insurgent. And this one actually I wrote as maybe a series thinking about gestation and birth and after the birth of my daughter. Sweet Insurgent. Outside the flesh, the wind's a hinge, broken both ways. Some forms of breakage cause no real harm, but that's not why we're here. Pathe mathos, says Aeschylus, we suffer into knowledge. But what if we only suffer into dumb surprise? What, say the rotors of my friend's helicopter just before going down. Rotors without lift. Rotors more heart murmur than murmuration. But after impact, he opened the door and walked away. Hello, tenacious earth. Sometimes you have to practice crying uncle for years to make it stick. Maybe because I don't want to be sliced open, I covet interiors. Make your address also my own untouchable. Dear hidey hole, dear den of snakes. I even covet the hazard music of your hands, their rain on flashing, their morsed every other note pried up. In the harm disposer's handbook, not every bomb can be dismantled, so it must stay buried, one good ear bent and ticking in the dirt. And this one recently I submitted to American Poetry Review as sort of my rule of submission is like I submit one that I feel really good about and a couple that I think are finished and then one just kind of on a whim, why not, it's number four. And almost inevitably, it's the why not on a whim poem that gets taken, which is maybe evidence of the fact that you're not always your own best judge or something. But so this is in the most recent issue of APR. We're no Robert Capa photo. Are you familiar with Robert Capa's war photo? Yeah, sort of iconographic. We're no Robert Capa photo. Sweet fellowship of field. The troughs embrace our thighs like shields. Your body buttoned neatly into shade. Say, once we're soldier, those were the days. They weren't. Serrated sky to sawgrass, our sight. Once we're blades. Once crowbarred back the night's facade to see how we were skeined. The light of us, a fist. A derelict scrap of earth, the mortars missed. And this is the last poem I'll read. Forms of protest. All month long, police in riot gear crowded our city like novitiate whales learning the trick of baleen. Of all the underwater currents, never mind the one that's going to turn. A mother I know just buried her son, but that's only an expression. She had him turned into ash. Easier to imagine the big, peaceable bodies of whales, their cargo, their bioluminescent wattage, than a mother's attendant grief. A hunger so vast the whole goddamn ocean pours black and guppied and vigilant into your throat. Thank you.
We will now begin the question and answer session. Because this event is being taped, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before asking your question.
I know it's intimidating because I have wires and things.
So you said that your last poem was written about a protest. Were the rest of your poems in Clamor written as a protest to the war in Iraq as well, or just kind of?
No. And as a matter of fact, yeah, that last poem I read is called Forms of Protest. And you know, I had the title and I had the poem, and they were two totally different things. Until I recognized, it was one of those like, oh, holy shit, what a dumbass. Here it is. This is the poem. You just cut that poem and move it over. These are the forms of protest. And they took on the, as soon as I had done that, I realized, of course, here are these multiple forms of protest. And it was written after the Occupy Wall Street had kind of run amok in my city and thinking about all these various forms of protest. So I think... You know, I didn't write Clamor as necessarily a protest. I think sometimes, you know, it's hard to write about, you know, when we write about war, we are in some ways writing a kind of protest, if only because it's atrocious. And how can you write about something atrocious without registering some kind of feeling, some kind of regret or some kind of feeling or recognition of that atrocity? But that's a good question.
Hi. I was wondering if maybe you could speak about your experience as a wife at home while your husband was at war, and how your like kind of sporadic communication with him affected you and I guess your relationship.
Sure. Yeah. And we were, I was also talking with students about how, I mean, this is a different kind of war, right? We have communication, and I was lucky to have lots of communication in a way that people just didn't in the past. So, and I was saying that it kind of gave us a false sense of intimacy. Like, you have kind of the illusion, and it's true. I mean, you do have contact, and in some ways that makes it harder, I think. Like, we, you know, apart from, like, the phone bills, when we did have, you know, so sometimes we'd have the occasion to talk on the phone, and honestly, it was kind of awful, because it was, like, the novelty of hearing the voice, but it was disconnected and detached, and it was just a reminder of everything you didn't have. And so it was actually much easier for us to write and instant messaging. I mean, we had access to instant messaging a good deal of the time. And that form, it just felt more natural. We had we were able to fit our rhythms. We had we both had the rapport that was natural without that sort of that stark absence. I mean, you know, there's all of those various forms of presences just bring up the fact of the absence. So it was a strange time. For me, it feels like a very long time ago. And it was. I mean, I was in grad school. I didn't know anybody who was like remotely knew something. Or maybe I knew people, but I felt like I was undercover. And I kind of maintained that because, you know, my first week at my MFA program, it was like one of those like meet and greet cocktail parties. And my future professor, one of my future professors, was like, oh, hey, where's your husband? And I was like, well, he's in Iraq. And she like spat out her cocktail wiener, whatever it was she was eating, and was like, well, how did he get there? And after that, I was a lot more cautious about like, you know, outing myself, because that's what it felt like. And you know, nobody. We have these notions about what a soldier looks like or what a soldier's wife looks like, and I didn't conform to those standards. So it was a weird, you know, I was like passing. I was passing as, and I was a civilian, but it was strange. It's a very, you know, it's a different experience from being a base wife, which has its own, I'm sure, fraught bag too.
Going back to sort of your workshopping the poems, did you find that there was anything unique either that you sort of felt or that you felt from the workshop when it came to going over the poems in Clamor?
Did I find something unique, like something uniquely valuable from the workshop? Is that what you're asking?
Uniquely valuable or just unique to the experience of writing the poems in Clamor versus other works?
So the poems in Clamor, I didn't set out to write that book. You know, I was writing other things, and then I was also writing some of the poems that would become Clamor. And as soon as I recognized, I think everyone else had recognized I was doing it before I recognized it myself. Again, dumbass that I am sometimes in these things. Like, sometimes you get so deep into it, you need to step back and get that perspective. But so other people recognized that I was doing this, and so had that perspective and could help me sort of chart the terrain a little bit. I worked with Dorianne Lux, the poet, who, while we had very different styles and aesthetic approaches, she was really great at pushing me to the uncomfortable terrain. So getting me to go to the place that I really didn't want to go, like where reading the poems would just make me like sweat buckets in front of class. Like, I can't believe I'm doing this. I hadn't been pushed in that way before. I had always sort of, my response to kind of personal crisis was to become more linguistically aloof, to create some kind of distance, to pad my own experience by thinking about the language instead of using it as access point.
So I have a question not only about the poetic devices that you use, but about the audience. In terms of when you're reading poetry at a poetry reading or at a university or a bookshop, I'm wondering, is it different for you based on who's listening? Do you have people that are more interested in the content, maybe if they're connected to war vets, or if they're more interested in the literary devices and the choices you make in your poetry? And I was wondering if you could comment on that from your perspective and your perceptions and what it's like for you dealing with such a wide array of people.
Yeah. I think that I generally have like a set list, like a structure. And because I think that, you know, when I go to readings, like I have a hard time listening after a while and I need something to pull me through. And so I think that the structure, that sort of slight narrative is sometimes enough, to pull a reader through. So I try to stick to some from that movement, some from each of those movements. And you know, I think if I hear that somebody wants to hear something, or I'll go there. But for the most part, I mean, I think that the poems resonate in different ways. I hope that they do. So the poem, you know, there might be a poem where somebody is interested in like the figuration, and somebody else is like, right, that's what it looks like, or yeah, I had that experience. So hopefully they're working at the same time.
So I was really interested in your use of Dante, just because I love Dante, and this could be a silly question, and maybe other people are bored by it, but why Beatrice? Of all of the literary women you could have chosen, why Beatrice?
Well, for one, I did try a lot. I did like go to different places, but the Beatrice, I think the poem that I realized I was using Beatrice for the Refusing Beatrice poem, because I was rejecting this role. But I was interested in Beatrice, who's not really present in Inferno. But I was aware of the Beatrice behind the telling, that there was this figure, this idealized figure there. And so I was interested in her story and investigating it to recognize that this was not, that I wasn't embracing it. But you know, I think there's, you know, we go to the classics when we read about war, when we think about war, and there's a lot to bolster us and there's a lot to reject, and both sort of simultaneously. So, you know, I mined a lot of that, only to discover that you know, the figures weren't doing what I wanted them to, or I was finding resistance.
Hi. I know in the poem Garden...
Disembodied. Oh, okay.
that you used the east and the western sky to counterpose, and that took on a symbolic meaning, because I felt like before and after the war. But did you use it as a symbolic meaning? Was it just coincidence, or did you kind of like fudge the actual details of reality to incorporate the symbolism into it?
Yeah, that last point, the like fudging of the details, I mean, I think that's a given. That's like, that's a given in all of this. And that's an important question. Because people ask me like of different poems, oh, well, did you do this? Did that, what was that specific thing like? And it's like, well, it's not exactly like that. And after I won this prize, people wanted to do interviews with my husband. And he doesn't want to talk about it for many good reasons. But people were reading this, you know, I think there's a tendency to read this journalistically sometimes. And it's not even, we don't even have to say fudging details, because it's poetry. Like, this is what, you know, there's more truth to our reconstruction oftentimes. So it's really interesting. I encounter that question all the time, and I think it's important. I mean, I'm trying to retrain myself a little bit in when I approach, because, you know, I think it's natural to read kind of autobiographically, and it's true. I mean, this is rooted in my experience very much so. But yeah, those details, like, well, what did you do if you were actually facing in the other way? And it's like, well, here in the poem, this is how it's happening. and this is how it's working. And so it's not even fudging details. It's the poem is creating that scene.
Hi. Hi. I'm interested in hearing what you think as a poet writing today is the function of poetry today, and sort of how it's different than it has been, or what you foresee the future of poetry is looking like?
That's a good question. And I'm saying that only to stall. I don't think that the role of poetry has changed all that much, but I think that maybe the importance has, has heightened. But I think, you know, it's the poet's job in various ways to access or to lay bare to a poetic lens everything, and to not turn away, and to not privilege one narrative over another, but to make everything accessible to poetry. And I think that's always been the case, and I think maybe now more than ever, it's important. And that takes on many different forms. I also don't know what's going to become. I mean, the readership is changing of poetry in different ways, and I also talked with some students about, you know, what's happening. Everyone's tweeting, and our public lives are out in the world. And you go to I think the American Poetry Society of America. There's one website that used to be just have. Just like you'd go to a poet, you'd find their poems, and they'd be listed. And now they have the scroll. Do you guys know what I'm talking about? Like the poems that scroll, and they're not actually like it's some new app or something. And they're not. They don't scroll the way that the poet lineated them. They scroll because to fit the screen. And it drives me nuts because it's like a line will come and it'll disappear, and the next line will come and it'll disappear, and you don't have access to what comes before and what comes behind. And I like seeing a poem. I mean, I want to see, because I want to be able to look back and see the echoes and see the rhymes and see, you know, whatever else is happening. And this technology, I mean, this particular technology, and I don't want to be a naysayer, but it's this weird, creates this kind of amnesiac reading. And I don't, you know, I don't know how, you know, I think our reading is changing, but I don't know what that means, if anything, for our role as poets.
Hi, I just had a quick question. Have you ever shared the poems in Clamor with your husband? Like, were you sharing them with him while he was away? And did he ever like give you feedback, or was it? Because I feel like when you read it, you kind of get his perception of the war, and I don't know if he ever expressed, like, no, that's not what happened, but I was just wondering if you shared it with him.
Yeah, I mean, I think the caveat is that this is not my husband's experience, and this is not necessarily mine. This is the poem. These are the poems happening through this experience. But they were. I mean, I feel like there's a certain vein that I struck in communicating my own experience. And so, yeah, he'll, you know, if you get us together, it'll be like, no, it didn't happen that way. It happened that way. No, you're not remembering that, you know. And we have these memory blips over everything, I think. So he, you know, he's distanced himself from this. But at the same time, like, I was sending him poems, and he ran an aid station, and so there was a door. He slept in the bathroom of the aid station was his room, and so that door to the public was, he had domain over it. So he would sometimes, I would send him poems, and he would put them up on the door. That's my phone. Sorry, you guys. It's probably like my babysitter calling. That's embarrassing, but it's not your fault. Yeah, the publication on the bathroom. Yeah, so actually my first audience for some of these poems were like the people who came to be treated at the aid station. So yeah, so while, I mean, he has sort of a complicated relationship to this work, and I know that he's going to be glad when I have the next book, and I will not be. people won't turn. I mean, because you know he comes to my readings when he can, and it's not comfortable for him to be seen as this figure who he's not.
Hello, yes. You mentioned earlier about perspective and how you tried to get into, you managed to get into a different perspective, like with the wet, the war bride and such.
The persona.
So I was wondering, how exactly did you manage to get to like that level of being able to go into a different experience that you haven't had and cannot necessarily understand? And also, what if you ever thought of doing that or ever did do that with other poems in Clamor or at all?
Well, for one, it was a lot easier to write in persona, to write in third person, to imagine that I was just creating this thing. It was way easier than it was to just write like a poem like Planting Hayhurst Farm. That was a really hard poem to write. And that's much more direct and kind of and clean spoken. And but the persona poems, you know, I was like, all right, I'm creating this character. You know, I know a little bit about this character, but I'm just going to create this character. And it gave me the freedom to access the stuff that I think I wouldn't have been able to access. I love persona poems. I've written a whole lot since then. And always it's like, okay, well, what would happen if this actually became a first person poem? And I shift second person and third person. There's a lot of, the pronouns are a little bit shifty. In I think particularly the prose poems there, and my editor wanted me to unify them all, and I refused because I wanted that shiftiness was sort of evidence of a conflicted approach to how we get at this material and who gets at this material, who has, you know, possession over it, and we all do.
You talked a little bit before about this idea of like newscaster language, I think you called it. I was wondering if, like, you know, the use of a phrase like loss of life instead of, you know, maybe might be oversimplifying what's actually going on. And I was wondering, you know, do you think this distorts the public's image of what's actually going on, or, and how this sort of tied into your ability to use that language in something, something that has a lot of meaning, but, you know, using, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder might be, you know, less effective than something like shell shock, or just wanted your thoughts on that.
I don't know how much, you know, I know that we are capable of breaking down, you know, we can all say, oh yeah, well, you know, loss of like death, troop, soldier, collateral damage, like, you know, I mean, we know how to break down that equation and figure it out, and it's not like we're blind to it. But when you hear this or see this on the radio, on like, you know, the scroll bars in on TVs, like, it seems so cavalier and so easy. You know, it comes so easily. It seems to come so easily from newscasters' mouths, and so I don't know. I don't know if it alters our perception. I mean, I don't think it. I don't think it does, but it does. It does affect the tone and our reception. And it's hard, you know. I think over the year that my husband was deployed, I went back and forth on like how much media I consumed, like going to media and turning from it. And somebody actually asked about the static on the TV in my house, and actually I didn't have a TV, but there was static. You know, there was always static everywhere, and we're surrounded. I mean, I think it has both effects. You know, it calls our attention to the disjunction, and it also allows us to be lulled by it, depending on kind of what we want from it. It allows us to not come out and have to say it. And the process of saying it is a process of navigating it, I think.
Hi, I'd kind of like to return to your comment about when you're communicating with your husband and your decision to use instant messaging instead of the phone. I'm just sort of curious, what was it about writing that made communication easier? I know you said it was because hearing a voice reminds you of what you don't have, but I sense in some of your poems, like after the blast and word from the front, an effort to sort of visualize and make things concrete. Like, it's almost sensory. And even your use of gardening imagery, you're touching, it's tactile. Is the communication, like, is writing, does it help you distance yourself from what you're writing, or does it make it something physical that you can both share?
Probably both. But yeah, I think that the physical, I mean, it's funny. I think that the physicality of, I mean, language is physical, and it's something that, you know, we have a record of it too. Like, the phone calls happened and I didn't, you know, they weren't recorded. They happened and they were gone. But I have this record. I mean, I have a huge record of IAMs between us. And so that, yeah, I mean, I embraced that physicality. That was a gift. That was a physical gift in a way that was easier also to, for obvious reasons, that was easier to digest, I guess, than the, like, fleeting, fraught phone call. And also, I mean, it was cheaper. And it's you know, navigating the distances and all kinds of practical reasons. But really, I mean, the phone calls are hard. And I think also we're both writers in some way. He's a lawyer, and so language is dear.
Thanks.
So, as a poet, would you say that you sit and think through every word of every stanza, or do you write freely, allowing your words to flow?
Both. Depending. A whole lot of both. Yeah, sometimes the poems would happen complete. Rarely, but sometimes. And sometimes there's just the constant tweaking and, like, this isn't right. Even the poems that ended up in the book, some of them are like, really? That's what I ended up with? Like, I'm still, you know, I still fight the urge when I'm reading to, like, revise them on the spot. So, yeah, some kind of go out in the world on their own, and some are still, like, throwing their lifeboats back at me or something.
Time for two more questions.
Do you think that your more recent poetry has kind of moved away from the topics of war? And do you think in the future you will continue to write about war or about different subjects?
I think the concerns will always be the same, but they take on different form and different kind of aesthetic interests and different narrative interests, different lyric interests. But, you know, I think as poets, like, we're often plumbing the same depths, you know, we're in the same vein, and it takes many, many writings to get to the one. And it's hard. I mean, even as I try to, like, give myself space and turn away from that content, I found, like, the poems, you know, I set myself a kind of task to write a series of sonnets in the voices of trees that I was doing with a friend of mine who had very different experience. And we were writing sonnets back and forth, and it was like quaking asp and apple tree. And then slowly, like, date palm worked its way in, and like, without me noticing it, I was writing poems about, if not war, then waiting, if not waiting, then the potential for a loss. But these are, you know, these are human concerns. I mean, these are writer concerns regardless. So I think that they'll always be there in some way. They just find different forms.
Hi. Excuse me. If you could talk about the time that you were developing these poems, not knowing that you were writing a book, and then what led you to get to that publishing point, if you could expand upon
that. Yeah. So I wrote all of, two-thirds of these poems I wrote over the course of my MFA program in 2 years, which is way more prodigious than I normally am. And it was the first, it took probably the first year of writing these poems for me to recognize that I was writing them, by which point I had a fair number, and then I was finally able to, like, turn my attention back to them. So, and you know, we had to hand in a thesis, and I wanted it to be something that I was gonna leave the MFA program with and be able to work on my own. So you know, my MFA thesis was Clamor, and it was like 40 pages, mostly probably 85% the same. And then over the next year or two, I was trying to figure out how to be a writer and not be in school. I was working at another farm, and I was teaching and had moved. And so I was writing. I was trying to keep to a schedule more diligently than I had before because I feared all of that freedom sort of collapsing it. And I also knew that, like, this was a book, or it was close to being a book. I allowed myself, I think, another year to write back into it. And then I started sending it out. And it was like, you know, I think it always feels like an arbitrary point where you're like, okay, this is the book. And you have to make that call, or have somebody, have a good friend make that call for you. And I submitted the first year. I was submitting to first book competitions, which, you know, it's not necessarily the best advice. You don't have to win a competition to get a book published, although it certainly feels like you do. And it's expensive. I mean, every time you send it out, it's like 20 or 30 bucks a pop. So I have friends who had sent their manuscripts who would never recover that money, even after winning a contest, like by a lot. And so I had a figure in my head where I was going to stop and sort of reevaluate. And the first year I sent it out 6 times, and it was a finalist in one contest. And that was enough to, like, okay, I had to be serious. And then the next kind of season, I sent it out to a couple places, and then I had, like, a drunken night with a friend of mine who was like, so where'd you submit? And I told him, like, the 4 places, and he laughed in my face. He laughed because he was like, you got to be sending out to, like, 50 places. And I was like, well, I don't have the money. But he's like, okay, we'll send it here, at least. And I did, and it ended up winning. And, I mean, I got lucky fast. But there are now, I think, more open reading periods than there were even 5 years ago. and I think you can do a little bit of research to find the free ones. But even after I'd collected it, I had friends who were reading it and who were commenting and giving me totally conflicting advice. And I think the value, probably, honestly, like, the best thing the MFA program did for me was allow me to ignore readers, like, to figure out, like, oh no, I'm actually going to rely on myself on this one. Like, I have your input. I know how, you know, but I'm going to, it kind of gave me the power to rely on myself. And that's what I need to finish it and to send it out as a manuscript.
Please join me in thanking Elise Fenton. I wanted to remind everyone of the book sale and signing that will be occurring right over here following this presentation. Thank you. Have a great evening.